at all. As I felt it, my awareness of selfhood had been pronounced a delusion. I drifted into a sort of fugue state, neither aware nor unconscious. An attendant came round with food, but I ignored him. Night fell, but I didn't sleep. The rain stopped and the sun rose without my noticing. Soon the crowds came, calling out, "Goliath, Goliath," but I paid no attention. Several days passed in this way. Then one evening I took a long drink from my bowl and fell asleep. A powerful sedative had been added to my water. At dawn, I awoke in an unfamiliar cage. At first, because it was so large and strangely shaped, I didn't even recognize it as a cage. It was circular and open to the air on all sides. As I later understood, a gazebo had been modified to serve the purpose. Except for a large white house nearby, it stood alone in an attractive park I imagined must extend to the ends of the earth. I was still exploring my new home when, around mid-morning, I looked up and saw that I was not alone. A man was standing just beyond the bars, blackly silhouetted against the sunlit house in the distance. I approached cautiously and was astonished to recognize him. As if reenacting our former encounter, we gazed into each other's eyes. I saw that, dry and freshly dressed, he was not the elderly person I'd taken him for. His face was long, dark, and bony. His eyes burned with a strange intensity, and his mouth seemed set in an expression of bitter mirth. At last he nodded, exactly as before, and said, "Yes, I was right. You are not Goliath. You are Ishmael." Once again, as if everything was now finally settled, he turned and walked away. And once again I was thunderstruck, but this time by a feeling of profound relief, for I'd been redeemed from oblivion and made whole again. My benefactor was a wealthy Jewish merchant of this city, a man by the name of Walter Sokolov. On the day he discovered me at the menagerie, he'd been out walking in a kind of suicidal gloom that had descended on him a few months before, when he learned that his entire family had been swallowed up in the Nazi Holocaust. His wanderings led him to a carnival set up at the edge of town, and he went in without thinking. Because of the rain, most of the booths and rides were shut down, giving the place an air of abandonment that accorded well with his melancholy. At last he came to the menagerie, whose chief attractions were advertised in a series of lurid paintings. One of these, more lurid than the rest, depicted the gorilla Goliath, brandishing the broken body of an African native as if it were a weapon. Perhaps thinking that a gorilla named Goliath was an apt symbol for the Nazi giant that was then engaged in crushing the race of David, Walter Sokolov decided it would be satisfying to behold such a monster behind bars. He went in, approached my wagon, and by gazing into my eyes soon saw I was no relation to the bloodthirsty monster in the painting, and indeed no relation to the Philistine tormentor of his race. He found it gave him no satisfaction to see me behind bars. On the contrary, in a quixotic gesture of guilt and defiance, he decided to rescue me from my cage, and fashion me into a dreadful substitute for the family he had failed to rescue from the cage of Europe. The owner of the menagerie was agreeable to a sale. After letting me settle in for a day in my new surroundings, Mr. Sokolov again visited the gazebo, and we gazed at each other in a long silence as before. Finally, reluctantly, as if surmounting some daunting interior barrier, he began to speak to me, not in the jocular way of visitors to the menagerie, but rather as one speaks to the wind or the waves, uttering that which must be said, but which must not be heard by anyone. As he poured out his sorrows and self-recriminations, he gradually forgot the need for caution. After an hour, he was propped up against my cage with a hand wrapped around a bar. He was looking at the ground, lost in thought, and I used this opportunity to express my sympathy, reaching out and gently stroking the knuckles of his hand. He leapt back, startled and horrified, but a search of my eyes reassured him that my gesture was innocent of menace. Alerted by this experience, he began to suspect that I possessed real intelligence, and a few simple tests convinced him of this. Satisfied that I understood his words, he leapt to the conclusion that I should be able to produce some of my own, and decided to teach me to talk. I'll pass over the painful months that followed. Neither of us understood that the difficulty was insurmountable, owing to a lack of basic phonic equipment on my part. But at last a day came when I couldn't go on, and in my anguish at not being able to tell him this, I thought him this, with all the mental power I possessed. He was stunned, as was I when I saw that he'd heard my mental cry. I won't burden you with all the steps of our progress once full communication was established between us. They're easily imagined. Over the next decade, he taught me all he knew of the world, the universe, and human history. And when my questions went beyond his knowledge, we studied side by side. And when my studies carried me beyond his own interests, at last, he cheerfully became a sort of research assistant to me. By the early 60s, I was like a house guest who needed very little attention from his host. So Mr. Sokolov began to be seen again in society. Soon he was engaged to be married. The prospect of marriage pleased him, but he made a terrible mistake in anticipation of it. He decided our special relationship would be kept secret from his wife. It wasn't an extraordinary decision for those times, and I wasn't sufficiently experienced in such matters to recognize it for the error it was. I moved back to the gazebo, but from the first, Mrs. Sokolov viewed me as a peculiar and alarming pet, and began agitating for my removal. Luckily, my benefactor was used to having his own way and made it clear that my situation was unalterable. A few months later, he dropped in to tell me that his wife, like Abraham's Sarah, was soon going to present him with a child of his old age. "I anticipated nothing like this when I named you Ishmael," he told me. "But rest assured, I won't let her cast you out of my house the way Sarah cast your namesake out of Abraham's house." Nevertheless, it amused him to say that if it was a boy, he would name him Isaac. As matters turned out, however, it was a girl, and they named her Rachel. Wisely or foolishly, my benefactor decided I would be the girl's mentor, and wisely or foolishly, I was delighted to please him in this way. In her father's arms, Rachel spent nearly as much time with me as with her mother, which of course did nothing to improve my standing with that person. Because I was able to speak to her in a language more direct than speech, I could soothe and amuse her when others failed, and a bond gradually developed between us that might be likened to the one that exists between identical twins. Mrs. Sokolov looked forward to the day when Rachel would begin school, for then new interest would make her a stranger to me. When this didn't happen, she renewed her campaign to have me sent away, predicting that my presence